Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
I want to bring in a guy who has a piece that he's written. It's not the Bay Observer, but it's a piece that I think some of you are probably going to be answering in your own head if you were to read it. The headline is, "Have You Had Enough?" And in it, he, well, I don't know that eviscerates is an improper word, our city council, for many of the decisions and things that have been happening down at City Hall in the first year and a third of their mandate. His name is Vito Scro. He's a former mayoral candidate, former provincial candidate. He's a political insider, joins us now. Vito, how are you today?
The perfect name is the Rough Rider, Scott. They've got to be the Rough Riders.
That would be.
It works in football. Why wouldn't it work in Salt Lake City?
Well, only if they have two teams down there. Only if they can change the Utah Jazz to the Rough Riders as well, so they have both. Then it really works.
There you go.
So, Vito,
I'm doing
said
well. Thank you.
I said eviscerates. Is that a fair word for what you're feeling towards council and what they've been doing?
I think it's truthful. And I've got to tell your listeners, I mean, it's not easy to write, and you will know more than anything about that. It was probably twice the length, and John had to edit it. There was a lot more than that, but I don't think there was anything not truthful in that whole piece. It's just, I think there's a structural and inherent problem we have. There's systematic problems at the city. You know, we really can't seem to be doing anything right.
Do you think that this is... we got a lot of things to talk about this, so we'll get into a lot of the points here. But with what you just said, is that different from other councils, or is this a continuation in your mind of other councils?
I think there are systematic problems, basically problems that are just built in that nothing could get done anyway. And I think it's getting worse as the years have gone on. And I don't know what the reasoning is. I mean, while I was listening to go on here, I was reading about how the problems with the IT, the ransomware, it's going to take a year to fix. How is that possible? How is it going to take a year? Where were the backups and all these things? Now, what happened isn't their fault. These really bad people are out there in the world doing this, but the backups should be in place. And maybe it takes a month, maybe it takes two, but a year? That tells me there's some severe problems in that department. I've never heard from the IT person who's in charge. It was always either the mayor or the CAO. But what happened? Like, that's just another example. So they just started taking the money from tax installments. I think it was today or yesterday. It took 2 months for that. Like, why?
Well, that's an area that I don't have any IT ability whatsoever, so I can't answer that question. But I'm sure there are other people who are asking as you are. I don't think you're the only one who would be asking that question, especially about the backups. And we haven't really had an answer about that. And I don't know, Vito, it's an interesting one, because I don't know if that's something that we should expect that the city would have, or if this is so unusual that we shouldn't expect the city to be able to deal with this, because there's other cities that are dealing with it too.
Well, of course. And I'm just using that as an example. Sure. I literally was just reading that while I was just waiting to get on with you. And another example, I was talking to some people at the city, and boy, there are people at the city who will talk to anybody. They're just frustrated. We're talking about Stony Creek and that issue with the parking lot.
Yep.
Apparently, if that goes through, that could take 3 to 4 years to build. I don't understand what the mayor's reasoning for doing something like that, dividing the community, where a project might not happen within this term. Why would you do that? Again, and why would it take 3-4 years for any project to get going? I just don't understand what the problem. We've got bigger problems than just individual issues. Those are just the symptoms. It looks like we don't know how to do anything in this city, and I don't know why.
We are chatting with former political candidate, political insider Vito Scro, about a piece he wrote, "Have You Had Enough?" And it is a scathing indictment, quite honestly, of city council that I think there are going to be those out there who will agree with the sentiment that many of the things that seem to be happening at City Hall are frustrating people. There are those, let's not make a mistake here, let's not confuse ourselves. There are those who think what's happening there is that they're doing God's work and that it's good things that are happening there. But I say, I think a lot of people probably are wondering, I thought this was the council that was supposed to be all about change and doing everything differently and making people happier with what was going on. And on that point, Vito, I'm not sure how many people, whether they support what's going on there or not, I'm not sure how many people are looking at this and saying, this is exactly what we had in mind when we said change.
No, I agree with you 100%. I don't think anyone is happy right now. And look, let's be quite fair. It is a tough time in the last year or two, especially with the housing crisis and the issues with the cost of food and things like that and inflation. But having said that, they are not working together. It looks like the battle lines are being drawn up, and there's definitely eight on one side and eight on the other. And depending on what happens the next GIC or the next council meeting, I have a bad feeling of what's coming. What happens if some of the councillors in the East End, Stony Creek, for example, as I write about, what happens if they just start picking spots and Waterdown, Ancaster, Dundas to put?
Well, I wrote about this, Vito. I wrote about this. And funny you mentioned that, because, look, I was surprised that Mayor Andrea Horvath used the political capital that she did to go with the strong mayor powers, because it's for 67 units. And I get that we're trying to push through, we've got a housing crisis, affordable housing, we're trying to push this through. That seemed like it was not a lot of units to use up that kind of currency politically that she did, especially with what you just said, that as far as I know, there is no project ready to go. There's no developer, there's no builder. It could be a long way down the road.
Right.
And then,
and what about the businesses on in Stony Creek? I mean, now they're hearing we could lose our parking lot. And you have a counselor from the other side of town saying, well, there's other parking. Yeah, those are private lots. What are you going to park on somebody's driveway? You know, the Village Inn has a couple of spots behind their spot, he pointed out. Well, he's not going to let anybody park to use the medical building down the street. I mean, it's asinine, the reasoning here. 3,000 people signed a petition. The school board and a bunch of counselors are talking about a property down the street that is closer, where you can walk to food stores and everything else you need and transit. And they're talking about an area that is not going to help anyone. There's no grocery stores nearby. Transit is limited in that area. They got to give their heads a shake here. They really, really have to. Again, it's just another symptom of what's wrong here.
Well, I want to go back to your point for a second, though, when you said, what if they put something in Waterdown or Ancaster or whatever? I think that's a very realistic possibility. I'll be very surprised, quite honestly, if some of those Stony Creek councillors who are ticked don't say, all right, you had a lot of say in what happened in our backyard. Now we're going to suggest, for example, that we build a affordable housing project behind the old Ancaster Town Hall by the lawn bowling courts on the parking lot there that is required. And I wonder, does the mayor, if that happens, to be consistent, does she not almost have to invoke her strong mayor powers again, or look like she's picking favorites in city?
And then what you're going to have is an 8-8 vote on everything going forward, and she's going to have to keep doing this. And is this how you build a city? I mean, we're talking housing. I live across the street from one of the biggest housing projects in the city, literally right across the street from me. There's hundreds of units still empty there. Shouldn't you worry about getting those up to, like, ready to be used before you start talking about things like that? There's maybe 200 units across the street from me empty. Why are they still empty? You know, why are you buying e-bikes for $700,000? Why are you scheduling up your bike lane things by $60 million? You've got these units that need to be refurbished to make them livable. And you're worried about things like that? Why is a counselor talking about giving a church $800,000 to build their concert hall better when there's people in tents across the street from that? Like, it just goes on. And really, you know what? It's that old thing in the movie. We're tired. We're angry. We're not going to take it anymore.
One of the things you say in this piece that you wrote, and it's funny because I think we may have chatted about this on the air, not you and I, but it's been a point that people have thought about, and I'm glad you listed it, which was regarding this idea of the parking lot in Stony Creek and the mayor and other councillors having a say in what happens in other wards. I think it would be a terrific idea and a real sign of leadership if every councillor who decided that Stony Creek should follow their idea would bring forward their own piece of property, a prime piece of property within their ward that is currently used for something else, and say, I am offering this up right now for affordable housing. We don't even have to debate it. I'm willing to give this piece of property. And you know what? The people in that ward may be furious. But if you were going to be consistent and you're going to lead, and this is the crisis as being described, that would be, to me, a sign of great leadership.
Well, we have 8,000 people on a waiting list, 15 wards, three projects each. Okay. That's about 500 units per ward. There you go. You've just solved your housing problem. But that's never going to happen, Scott. But if you believe in what you're doing, then you should be doing that. Then there's no argument. Every ward has got something they're planning to do when they're putting it forward.
I don't know. It seems to me that it shouldn't be that hard to do, because if it was important enough to tell the people in Stony Creek that their concerns were secondary to the housing issue, that our housing, affordable housing, and we can have that debate all day long, and I'm willing to hear that debate. But if we're going to say your considerations were not big enough for us to give them much thought, surely right. There is a place in your ward that you can do the exact same thing and show this is you wanting to solve the problem too.
That you're bang right on. And especially when in one ward, a private developer, and look, without private developers, you can get angry at them all you want. This will never be solved. There's not enough money in city coffers or federal provincial that can do this alone. Just get that through your head. That's number one. A private developer, yes, he was going to build a tower for profit, but he was going to build another one, make it truly affordable, subsidize it, and then give it to the city. And they turned that down because 35 people signed a petition and complained about parking in ward, I don't know if that's ward 3 or 4, but downtown.
3.
How can you in good conscience vote for Stony Creek after you've tried to stop that? That's insane. They got angry because he was going to make money. Duh. I mean, look at all the people, the richer people who give money to hospitals and art galleries and so forth. Do we get angry at that? No, they were told it's tax advantageous to them. I don't care. I wish more rich people would give so we could have things like this. There was going to be a tower with hundreds of units, and we said no.
Yeah, I again wrote this, and I don't know how Mayor Horvath now, with that Vrancor development that you're talking about in Ward 3, I don't know how she doesn't, if this comes back onto the table, and I wouldn't be surprised if one, especially if the Stony Creek councilors raises it, I don't know how she can possibly not invoke her strong mayor powers again and push this through. And to say, well, you know, there's flaws, it's not quite perfect, it's not the ideal thing. Stony Creek's parking lot was not the ideal thing. There were flaws. Nothing is perfect. I don't know. This is what I think has happened here. I think she has opened a Pandora's box that now is going to be very difficult to close. And I think that it's going to create very, very hard feelings. And I don't just mean with councilors, Vito. I mean across the city. If all of a sudden certain parts of town, there is no strong mayor power forcing stuff like this through, and other parts there is. I think that's going to be a huge problem.
Well, but then the problem is nothing is going to get done anywhere. I mean, look, you know, we've spoken, Scott, many times, and it just bothers me that I'm negative all the time. But there's just too many damn things that are wrong here. I mean, we could be that shining city on the hill, literally. If we got our act together, it wouldn't take a lot to do. We've got everything going for us, but we've got these counselors with their damn ideologies that really shouldn't play a part in how we run the city. I don't care if you're left or right. There's only right and wrong, not left or right. Why can't they just get together? We need housing. We need economic development. We need safe playgrounds. We need a whole bunch of different things. It's not that difficult if you get together, you know, but you keep doing it according to some leftist plan or right-wing plan or whatever. It's never going to get done, ever.
That is Vito Scro. Appreciate you doing this. You can go read it, by the way, at the Bay Observer if you want to go read what he wrote. Good idea to do so. Vito, appreciate the time today. Thanks.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
I'm sure there have been other mayors over the last little while who have been busy. I don't know of anybody who's been busier or doing more interviews or more in demand than my next guest. He is the mayor of Niagara Falls. His name is Jim Diodati. Thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me on again, Scott.
I know people by now, quite honestly, might be saying, really, more on the eclipse? Well, this will be our last eclipse segment, I'm quite sure, on the show. But your situation was very unique, and we don't really want to talk about the eclipse per se, but you were put into a very weird situation with the state of emergency and the prediction of a million people coming. And best I could tell, there were not a million people there.
No, the final police reports at the end of the day yesterday were there were over 200,000. We did not hit the million mark, and it's two obvious reasons for it. One was the weather. You know, I've said this many times, we're within a day's drive of almost half the population of North America. We have a very strong rubber tire market, and most of them are game time decisions. They get up, they check the weather, they make their decision. That was one. But the more impactful one was the declaration of a state of emergency. That definitely scared people off. As soon as the announcement was made, we had massive room cancellations.
Really?
Literally overnight. I heard from the hotel association. They were very, very upset. And they said, you know, why is this done? What's happening? And people were concerned. They didn't want to bring their families into an area knowing there's a state of emergency. They said, what's the emergency? Is there something that you know, you're not telling us? And so as a result, a lot of people felt they would just not come.
And that, I guess, for the hotels, when you mentioned the hotels, that's a bit of a double whammy, because we had heard some stories, I'm sure you did too, I don't know how legitimate they were, but of people who before had had rooms canceled, they said, to make room, apparently, for people to come to the eclipse. I mean, I don't know what the whole story was there, but it just, it seems like the hotels get sort of walloped here twice.
Well, they did, and I feel bad for the hotels, because that's not what happened, and it was some misinformation that, you know, some people that were canceled, you know, they went to the media with part of the story. The full story is the fact that we have a significant number of asylum seekers still in Niagara Falls for the last couple of years staying in our hotels. And the federal government does 3-month contracts, and they don't do them in advance. They're done every 3 months. And one of the hotels were booking, assuming the contract was going to be over, they were booking for the eclipse. Well, the federal government reissued the contract for another 3 months, so all the bookings had to be canceled. So it wasn't a matter of trying to get more money from other guests. It was a renewal of the hotel rooms for the asylum seekers.
So what is this? The state of emergency was something obviously that was controversial, because I think most people, when they hear state of emergency, not even thinking about what that could mean, but they think of something very specific. They think of a tragedy. They think of a earthquake or a hurricane or a tornado, whatever. And when there is a preemptive state of emergency, is there a lesson to take from this about the idea of declaring a preemptive state of emergency?
Well, I hope so. I mean, the city of Niagara Falls did not declare a state of emergency. We believe there needs to be one before you declare it, as you just mentioned. And secondly, I wish there was some consultation with us. We would have given a different perspective and maybe changed that decision. But unfortunately, once that decision was made and it was publicized, it went viral instantly around the world. And there's no getting toothpaste back in the tube. And at this point, all I could do is collateral damage and damage control. So here I was, you know, answering the question of something I didn't do. And unfortunately, it had a hugely negative impact. And I've heard from the casinos, I've heard from the hotels, the restaurants. And, you know, I hope the lesson is that that's not how you handle a potential threat. You prepare for it, but you don't want people to panic. That's probably the worst thing you can do.
There is a long way between 200,000 and a million. And even though 200,000 is a nice crowd, I find it hard to believe that 800,000 people might have come, but at the last minute decided not to. Was there ever in your mind a real possibility of a million, or was that a number that came out of the blue and was never realistic?
No, that was a number based on a major U.S. documentary company that was covering the eclipse. We've covered other eclipses throughout the U.S., and they were the ones that told us you should expect 8 to 9 times your biggest event. Our biggest event was Nyquilanda. We had 130,000 people here in Niagara Falls at one time. So we did the math and we said, well, that would put us at a million. They said that would be an accurate estimation, obviously depending on some factors like weather, but that was where that number came from, a group that had more experience than most. So we figured it's better to be overprepared than underprepared. And that was always our approach. We wanted to make sure that Niagara Falls was a safe destination. It's known as a family destination. And the last thing we need is something negative where something bad happens. And so we were, regardless, going to make sure that we were very, very prepared.
On that note, you have, due to, I would say, no fault of your own, but over the last number of years, you have been the city's number one explainer of things, whether it's what why people can't come for COVID or this or that, the accident at the border. There's a lot of times you've been doing interviews like this, explaining something to defend Niagara Falls. It seems as though this might have been not by you, but a self-inflicted wound that may be another case where you have to explain what's going on as opposed to just say, hey, thanks for coming.
Well, yeah, there's always a story to the story, right? And, you know, inside baseball, they call it. And as the city's mayor and I think chief brand manager, that's part of my job. We have to protect the brand. It's the most important thing. It's an iconic global brand. You know, one of the comments I always say, we're like the Coca-Cola of municipalities. And even though we're only 100,000 people, we fight way above our weight. We're the number one leisure destination in Canada with 14 million people here. And I've been blessed enough to travel to so many places around the world, and I've never yet met a person in any country that didn't have instant brand recognition. So we're very, very protective of it in the same way that Disney's protective of Mickey Mouse. It's so important that you need to take care of it. So sometimes there's misinformation. Sometimes there's miscalculations. Sometimes there's things out of your control. But regardless, you need to explain it and answer it. I think that's part of the job, part of the role. And it's not always good news. Sometimes it's bad news, but that's leadership. You're not there just for the good times. You're there for all times.
But do you worry that this has any kind of lingering thing that people who are going to go, you know what, the Niagara Falls, it's you know, you go there and I don't know. I don't know what might linger from this. Do you worry about that? Or is this a thing where you go, no, they'll be back tomorrow?
No, they'll be back tomorrow. It doesn't matter. We are so resilient here in Niagara Falls and in tourism. We've dealt with everything from mad cow. We've dealt with currency fluctuations, 9/11, of course, COVID. It seems so many challenges. There's always a new challenge on the horizon. And in this case here, it was a state of emergency, you know, and you just roll with the punches, and it's part of the marketing industry. You know, you market events and sometimes they go great, sometimes they don't. But one thing we know, the falls don't stop running. People will keep coming. And when you leave Niagara Falls, you usually take away great memories, and that's never going to change. And we just make sure that we're doing our best to put our best foot forward and always present Niagara Falls in the best possible light.
Just before I let you go, have you had a discussion with the region to say next time you're going to declare an emergency in our city, please don't?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it's ironic. I did have a good chat with Chair Bradley, and he's a real gentleman, and we get along great. And sometimes we disagree, and that's fine. It's okay to disagree or to agree to disagree. But that was my main thing was I said, Jim, I'll always try to take the high road, and I'll always try to find the silver lining in any gray cloud. And there's always a silver lining. And I said, I wish you had consulted with me, because I would have given you a different perspective and a different point of view. And maybe I said, I would have changed your decision. I would just respectfully ask me next time, bring me into the conversation. And that's kind of how we left it. I mean, we're friends, we're colleagues, and we respect each other. So that would be my expectation.
And thankfully the gray cloud parted just in time for the sun to be, the eclipse to be seen yesterday. So for those who were there, all ended well.
Oh, it did, Scott. It was just such a, you think about it, one of the great natural wonders of the world, Niagara Falls, one of the great celestial events of the universe happening at the same place at the same time. And the last piece of the puzzle, Mother Nature added a bunch of drama to the event with the clouds and then having them open up just in time for the 200,000 plus guests in Niagara Falls to see it, to experience it, to take pictures and video of it. Oh my God, that's going to be lifetime memories. And one other part I'll add to it, a neat little extra silver lining to the cloud. I got a call later in the day to see if I had time to meet up with James Cameron. James Cameron was here for the solar eclipse. And James Cameron, of course, grew up in Niagara Falls.
Yep. Titanic director, of course, and Terminator and others, for those who don't know the name.
Oh my God, Avatar, like the guys. Yep. Just absolutely legendary and a gentleman. So I did meet up with him and I said, you came, I couldn't believe it. And he was amongst the crowd down by the falls. And he said, wow, he goes, that was so memorable. He goes, I'll never forget that. And here's a guy who's done a lot of really neat things.
Yeah, for sure.
He said, I would love to do something special in Niagara Falls. So I'm hopeful that he does. But he said, there's no way I was going to miss a total solar eclipse in my hometown. So that was an extra little cherry on top.
We got to go. But there you go. The next James Cameron movie, Eclipse. Look for it at theaters near you. Mayor Jim Diodati, thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Don't know if you tuned in last night to watch any of the Jays home opener. Hopefully you were watching the show and you had the volume down, but you know, you were tuned in anyway, because the Rogers Center renovations look pretty impressive, gotta say. Just like last year when they did the outfield, the new lower level, it looks pretty impressive. Josh Goldberg is a guy who covers the Jays for The Score, joins us now. Josh, how are you today?
I'm well, Scott. How are you?
Good. Happy day two of the home season. I don't know. What's the official title for there's the home opener and then the home seconder? I'm not sure what it is, but whatever that is, welcome to it.
Thank you. Well, I would say it's usually historically where the crowd drops by like half.
At least.
Yeah.
Before we get to all kinds of other stuff, let's talk about the stadium for a second, because last year there was so much made of the outfield area and all the changes there. And most people gave it a pretty good thumbs up. And looking from a distance through my TV at the stadium now at Rogers Center, I got to say, looks pretty good too with the changes they made to that lower level.
Yeah, I would say so. It took some getting used to the backstop looking completely different. And that goes with anything. When you're used to something looking one way for such a long period of time, anytime there's a pretty drastic change, it's going to take some getting used to. But I think the changes are for the better. The biggest thing for me, for the fans in the lower bowl, is now all the seats facing the right direction, and there's no more sitting on an angle as you're close to the foul line. It's just going to be a more pleasant experience to watch a baseball game. And I think that that is what they were going for the casual baseball goer, like somebody who goes to a bunch of games a season. I don't know how much major changes to the ballpark are going to impact their desire to go one way or the other, because they're going primarily to watch the game. But I would say the majority of people who go to games throughout, especially the summer, I'm not necessarily certain that their primary objective is to watch every single pitch of the game. And there's no question that all the different changes over the last 2 years will cater to those people. And I think will keep people coming into the ballpark, even if the team maybe doesn't perform to the level that a lot of people hope and expect.
Is it good enough and improved enough that people will be willing and happy to pay higher prices? Because that seems to be the underlying point here. Let's make it nicer and then we'll charge more.
That's a good question. I don't know if I could go as far as to say that's the case. Honestly, I think people who are going to want to go, I think, to one or two games a year, okay, maybe that's not going to change the calculus too much for them. But I think for a lot of people, as the summer goes along, maybe if you just want to enjoy a nice summer evening or a nice summer afternoon, maybe that's not going to change much. But for people who want to go to a number of games a year, I think more than anything, it comes down to whether the team is competitive or not. And
yep.
I think we'll see what happens. But if the team is competitive and playing a style that is entertaining, then people will come. Like last year, the attendance in September wasn't as good as you would have hoped, because there just wasn't any energy around the team. There was no buzz. And this is, like, I will say this about Toronto, outside of really the Leafs. Toronto, to me, you could say this about a lot of sports cities, but Toronto, to me, is a bit of a front runner town. If the team is outside of the Leafs, look at the Raptors. If the team is not competitive or all the things that you need to really drum up interest, then I think attendance will suffer a little bit, especially considering how expensive ticket prices are and just how expensive everything is these days. Like, people just don't have the same level of disposable income that they did, unfortunately, before COVID. And I think that you're going to think twice about shelling out large dollars to go to a baseball game if the on-field product is not there. So I think a lot of it really does come full circle back to what does the team do between the lines.
And I think there's ample evidentiary proof of what you're saying. Look back, for those who can remember far enough back, to 2015.
Yeah.
And you could have charged almost anything for that playoff series with Texas. And in some cases they did. And it was full and people were happy to pay those ticket prices to get in there. So I think you're absolutely right. If this team is exciting and good, I think you can name, not name your price, but closer to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, within reason, no question. And I think there's unfortunately, I wouldn't speak for every Blue Jays fan, but I do think that for the first time in a while, there's a level of apathy that has set in when it comes to the fan base. Like, to me, this was the least energy surrounding a home opener in this current iteration of I guess contention, if that's what you want to call it. Like, you think back to obviously 2021 when they came home, there was all that buzz because they played a season and a half away from Toronto. 2022, there were a ton of expectations. 2023, there were expectations plus the renovations. And then this year, yeah, there were the renovations. And a lot of the jokes were, oh, well, at least there's cup holders now in the 100 level. Like, there just wasn't that level of, I just like oomph surrounding the team. And, you know, they came off of a pretty uninspiring road trip. They hit in a couple of games, I think three games, and they didn't hit in seven games. And it's sort of a carryover effect of last year. And it's not ideal that there is that already setting in, you know, 9, 10, 11 games into a season. I think it's on the team to play a certain way to get people excited again. And we'll see if they can do it. The first 11 games haven't really inspired a ton of confidence that that is necessarily going to be the case. But I think as long as you can win games more convincing fashion more often than you did last year, that will go a long way to getting some people who have maybe stepped off or stepped back a little bit in terms of their interest level, get them back in the fold.
And if nothing else, the way the new back behind home plate setup is, even if the game is terrible, it can be, okay, who's the celebrity who's sitting behind home plate? Because those seats are going to be, I think, where anyone who's got some money is going to be. That's a pretty exclusive area code now. That, how many seats? 50 or 60 right behind home plate?
Yeah, seems like it. And like anything, if it's a hot ticket, for sure, you'll probably see some recognizable faces there, especially in the summer.
We were talking last night on the show about the team itself, so I don't want to get too far into that again. But one other thing, though, that you and I were just chatting about before we came on tonight, and that's Mark Shapiro, who is the president of the team. He has done, I think now, full credit to him, the training facility in Dunedin gets incredible marks from everybody who uses it. Mm-hmm. The outfield new setup gets good marks, the lower level. This guy apparently is really good at building baseball facilities. I'm still not sure if he and Ross Atkins can be said to be good at building baseball teams.
Yeah, I think that's a 100% fair. They haven't won a playoff game, excluding 2016, but the core of that team was not theirs, right? There was some window dressing that they did throughout that season, but I don't really attribute that success to them. That was the last ember of the 2015 team. But since then, you know, they're 0-6 in the playoffs. They've been swept three straight times in playoff appearances. And I really look at, like, they were talking about how they wanted to be similar to the Dodgers, which is a really high bar to reach in terms of how you just become a factory in every level, right? You're just churning out prospects. They're either playing for you or they're being used as trade chips to make your team better. And you just repeat that cycle over and over. So you're never really out of it. And you look at the Dodgers, I think they've won the division 11 or 12 of the last 13 years, something like that. Like, it's a really sustained period of excellence and dominance. And the Blue Jays just haven't really done that, right? They haven't won the division under this management. And outside of an expanded playoff format, you could really look and say, well, would they be a playoff team without that? So, and I just don't think that they're in a great position right now. I just feel as though the franchise is in a really tenuous spot, a really delicate spot that if the season doesn't go according to script, then there could be some really difficult conversations to be had because the farm system is a bottom 10 by most publications. Like, it's not a particularly deep system. And even in terms of top end talent, there's not a ton there either. And at some point you have to think about, well, what's the long-term prognosis for this franchise? And Vladimir Guerrero, Joe Bobichet, not signed long-term. Not many players are signed for longer than a couple more seasons. And if this team doesn't really make a case that it deserves to be kept together for the most part long-term, then I think you have to look at maybe bringing in a whole new front office structure and, you know, putting a whole new spin on it, which is obviously not what Blue Jays fans want to hear, because that could mean several year lean years where you're taking a step or two or three back and not really in playoff contention, which would be tough to swallow after 22 years away from it and three playoff appearances in 4 years. It's not the best message to the fans that you might be in a position where you need to, you know, to look at 2, 3, 4 years where you're not exactly a playoff caliber team.
One more thing about this front office. They've played 8 games this year, but that means in their last 9 games, there have been at least 2, and that's a very high percentage, situations where fans have been really frustrated with a seeming reliance or absolute commitment to analytics over the eyeball test. I mean, Barrios last year in the playoffs, Davis Sanchez hitting the game-winning home run and then not playing. You can make an argument for these things, but baseball has always been, yes, analytics, but also feel, and it's human beings and everything else. Do you think this front office can or will ever relax their apparent conviction that they have to follow analytics first and foremost, or do you think that's just who they are?
I think there's... Like, this is always a there's a lot of nuance, I think, involved in conversations like this. I think, you know, to an extent, this, you sort of are who you are. I don't know if John Schneider, like, I think he has freedom to make lineup decisions. Like, I don't think anyone's saying this is the lineup and this is what you have to follow. But I think it's a collaborative process with a lot of information. There might be too many cooks in the kitchen for a lot of people's liking, which is fair, right? And sometimes you have to look at the overall state of affairs. I believe Davis Schneider is tied for the team lead in RBIs, and I think he's first or second in the team on the team in OPS. Yeah, he has historically struggled against right-handed pitching, and he has historically struggled against pitching, but particularly right-handed pitching with velocity up in the strike zone. But like, I've been thinking this is right now just a team that doesn't have enough threatening players offensively with the way that a lot of their guys have started the season. You need more threats in the lineup, and he is a threat. He's also a threat to strike out, but he is a threat to hit an extra base hit or hit a home run or something like that. So ideally you see more of that going forward, but I do think that there is going to still be a reliance on matchups and data and percentages and putting yourself in the best position beyond just, okay, well, a guy's going well right now. Let's throw him in there. No, like, it's not a great matchup, so we're going to back him off for a day. I still think there's probably going to be more than a lot of people would like.
Which would be a lot more palatable if all these matchups that they were pushing were turning out to work, but they're failing as often as the ones that you would have put in there. So anyway, let me go to a tweet that you sent out earlier this afternoon. And I just want to have a few minutes left here, and I want to talk about this because I think it's a huge story in baseball right now. That you tweeted out, it's becoming like a how many days since last accident with pitchers. This is after the Red Sox put Nick Pivetta on the IL with a right flexor strain. Baseball, we're a week and a bit into the season, and there is a rash of injuries, pitchers, arm injuries. What are you making of this? Because there's everybody now has a theory on what's going on. What's your theory?
So a lot of people are just knee-jerk will blame the pitch clock, which I think is probably a factor, a small factor though. Like I just don't think that you can be as, it can be as simplistic as saying the pitch clock is the reason for these injuries. Like, there's a lot of moving parts to this. Pitchers don't really get much of an offseason anymore. They're working round the clock. Like in the, back five, certainly 10 years ago, a lot of pitchers would not do anything from the end of the season until maybe January, and some might not throw their first bullpen session until the beginning of February. But Tommy John and elbow and shoulder and what have you injuries have been on the rise pretty drastically, even before the pitch clock. So I just think that, yes, pitchers are throwing probably too hard. There's a lot of spin, a lot of reliance on maximizing spin. And
which puts a lot of torque on your arm.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I mean, Justin Verlander had a really interesting, he was interviewed and it was on social media that I was watching. And he had a really interesting, like 4 or 5 minute take on this. And one of the things that he says, the Houston Astros great pitcher, he's just saying, look, teams now aren't even interested in a guy who isn't throwing maximum velocity every time. So you can't even, you know, there's just no rest. You go out there and you have to hump it up at your maximum with all that torque and all that spin and everything else. It hardly seems like a shock that the guys are getting hurt.
No, it really doesn't. And it's not necessarily, I don't think it's just as simple as, oh, guys throw too hard. Like you look at Shane Bieber, who he's not an overpowering pitcher. He throws like a 92 or 93 mile an hour fastball, but he throws a curveball that has as much spin as any pitch in baseball. And the repeatability is just not there. Your arm, no matter how well conditioned you are as an athlete, the human arm is just not meant to go through that motion so many times. Like to an extent, like it's just a ticking time bomb. And short of, I don't know, radically overhauling the game or how you prepare, like pitchers now, I think I read that the Tommy John ligament, I guess the UCL, doesn't fully mature until you're like 26 or 27 years old. And you have pitchers who are like 15 that are throwing 90. Like it's just not a sustainable model. Like I think at some point, every pitcher now, if you're throwing that hard or you're placing that much emphasis on spin rates and throwing a variety of different off-speed pitches, I think it's just a matter of time before you suffer a serious elbow injury. And you're probably just hoping it happens earlier in your career so it doesn't necessarily impact your prospects as a pro. So it's very unfortunate because you look at the number of pitchers and star pitchers who are not pitching right now because they suffered elbow injuries. It's not great for the game. And I'm not really sure what you do going forward. I don't think there's any easy answers.
We only have a few seconds left here, but I mean, look, Greg Maddux, I think, would have been able to find his way onto a major league roster and pitch no matter what, even though he didn't throw very hard. But it does look like most teams now, when they go out and scout, the number one thing they're looking for is a guy who throws high 90s. If you throw 88 as your fastball, chances are you're not even going to get looked at, which means the field of guys that are going to eventually make it into the majors are the guys who throw really hard, which then goes to what you're saying, where the arm can't take all that. So naturally, those guys that can throw so hard are the ones who get there. They're also the ones susceptible to this kind of injury. It all seems to make sense.
Yeah, well, and like think back to when somebody like a Aroldis Chapman was coming up. Yeah. It was crazy when he would throw 100. And now guys throw 100, 99, 100 so routinely that you don't even think about it anymore. It's just become second nature and commonplace. And I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing, but the game has just become so, I would say, just so enveloped by it that it's so ingrained in everything now that, you know, you're either looking for a combination of velocity and spin, or you're looking for, you know, a fastball that maybe you can get more ride on it or more extension if you're not throwing that hard, which the same thing, you're talking about higher spin rates and just more pressure on those ligaments that aren't really predisposed or just not, they're not meant to throw.
They're not built for that. Yeah,
that way. So I think, unfortunately, we're going to see more and more of this moving forward. And I wish there was some simple answer. I don't think it's as simple as saying getting rid of the pitch clock is going to necessarily do anything, because I don't think that's the case.
Don't let anyone throw a pitch in the majors who throws harder than 60. Yeah. You'll probably get rid of it.
Yeah.
Josh, it's not a real idea. Josh Goldberg, he's with The Score. You can follow him on Twitter at jgoldberg12. Josh, really appreciate the time today. Thanks.
Thanks, Scott.
The Scott Radley Show, weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.